News from NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, it's Computers in You. Today we welcome back science and technology reporter for the News Gazette, Greg Klein. Forgive me, Greg. Greg also writes two columns for the newspaper about computing. They run on Mondays in the circuits section of the paper. One's a question and answer column, the other a column featuring interesting websites. Listeners, we invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions. Here are the telephone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to be here, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, recently I got an email that looked very interesting to me. It was purportedly from eBay, and it looked really good, you know, but I've never been to the eBay site. Mm-hmm. So anyway, somebody was trying to fish me.
Yes, you've been fished, and not F-I-S-H, but P-H-I-S-H, as it's spelled in the computer world there. And as most people probably know or should know, that's an attempt usually by email to get you to give up valuable information about yourself. You know, it could be things like your name and address, but mostly what they want is your credit card numbers and bank account numbers and that kind of thing. It's pretty common to get a pretend email from eBay or from PayPal, the online payment service. It asks you to update your account, and in the process of doing that, one of the things they need, of course, is your credit card number. The thing to keep in mind, I think the primary thing that people need to keep in mind is that almost never does a legitimate company like eBay or PayPal or your bank ask you for that kind of information by email. And you should only submit that kind of information from a secure website that you know is the legitimate website of the entity you're dealing with, or by calling them at a good number, a number you know is good, on the phone. I say a good website because it's also, you know, not that hard to fake websites. You want to make sure you're getting to the right place, that it's a legitimate web address. One thing you'll find in fish emails often is a link. It says, click this link to go to our website and update your information. And you click that link and you go to what looks like, you know, a legitimate website, and you put in your information, and really you're giving it to somebody who has nefarious purposes in mind for it. So if you're going to do that, you need to make sure it's the right place.
Well, the email looked very impressive. I mean, it was animated and looked really like it could have been the real thing. Of course, as I said, I've never been to eBay. So that's a good tip off.
That's
right
a
there.
Tip off. Talented thieves.
Let's talk with our first caller this afternoon. Listener on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Heretofore, I've always used a laptop because I traveled. Lately, I just bought my first desktop unit. I don't do a lot of computing, just a little bit each day. And I don't have a whole ton of data. In 10 years of computing, I've only filled up 4 gigs. My question is about buying an uninterrupted power source in lieu of just a plain surge protector. If you buy one of those, does it perform the function of the surge suppressor, and also I'll have just a P4 80 gig standard Dell desktop, a 21 inch monitor, and a little external hard drive. Can you give me any guideline as to how big of a unit I should buy for the UPS.
All right. Yes, it should perform the surge protection capabilities. And as far as how big a unit you should buy, I'd buy the least expensive one that you can get, you know, from a legitimate company like ABC or somebody like that. Any of the, you know, electronic stores around here that sell those things, they sell name brand legitimate devices. I will say that you probably don't need it unless you know you have real concerns about the state of your power supply. You know, sometimes I suggest these things in particular for people that maybe live out in the country, you know, where the power lines are not as stable as they are in town, or they live in an old building where the power lines are not as stable as they are in town. And it's not a bad idea maybe to have one then, but otherwise a good surge protector would probably do as well for you and be a little less expensive than an uninterruptible power supply.
The reason I asked about the UPS in our neighborhood, I'm pretty sure the power goes off each and every day over Bicentennial. Will that cause a desktop problems in the past? Like I say, my experience, limited computing experience, just with laptops, which, you know, I only had those powered up when I was using them.
Well, it depends on what you mean by it goes off. I mean, does it flicker or does it go off for a period of time, you know?
I'm not home when it happens, yeah. But it makes me have to reset the various household appliances. It's off long enough to do that.
And you're going to leave the computer on when you're not at home, I take it.
I was thinking, now I would go like many people and get broadband and just leave the thing on all the time. Is that a bad idea?
No. A lot of people do it. I do it myself. And that's one of the advantages of having, you know, broadband internet access, that it's always there and you can go over and use it whenever you want. And it might not be a bad idea in your case to get something like that. Again, I wouldn't spend, you know, excessive amounts of money on it. I'd get pretty much the bottom line or a step above that in price. And, you know, that's going to give you on a machine like yours, it's probably going to give you, and you know, I'd have to look at the exact thing to know for sure, but it's probably going to give you 10 or 15 minutes, you know, of power. So I assume your power probably isn't out for 10 or 15 minutes a day, you know. And that ought to be adequate then.
And the fact that the monitor is a pretty big one, the 21, doesn't.
Well, yeah, it'll draw more power. It'll draw more power, but again, these things are you know, they're designed with this in mind.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call. Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line 4. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a question about internet telephone calls. I'm familiar with like the Net2Phone and things that you can do through instant messaging that use voice over IP, but a friend recently turned me on to something called Skype, which was created by the people who did Kazaa, and they talk about it being peer-to-peer versus traditional voice over IP, and I was trying to explain it to my dad last night. I actually used it to call him, and he was amazed at the clarity, but I did a horrible job of explaining the difference between traditional voice over IP and something that Skype does, which is more peer-to-peer.
And what's the question then?
Oh, I guess I was wondering if you could kind of maybe fill in some of those details, because I kind of didn't have a full understanding of the difference between traditional voice over IP and the what the program Skype uses.
Yeah, you're probably better at it than I am at this point. If you had to explain it to your dad, to most people, as long as it works, I don't think it makes much difference.
Okay, great. I didn't know if there was I didn't know if you knew anything about the difference between using a peer-to-peer type program as opposed to traditional voice over IP in terms of how it works.
Right. I think either can work equally well, and either can also be problematic because of traveling over a computer network.
Okay, great. Thanks. I appreciate it.
Okay.
333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area if you'd like to talk to Greg Klein this afternoon. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. No one waiting at the moment, so if you give us a call, you'll get right in. What else should we talk about here this afternoon, Greg, before we take our next call?
Well, we could talk a little bit about security, I guess, because that's always always a good topic.
Yeah.
And as I've mentioned again, and something that's been getting a lot of attention, I think, since the last time I was here, one of the ways that you can improve your chances of not getting nasty things on your computer, spyware and adware and viruses, is to use a different browser than Internet Explorer, which, you know, has been, although the number is falling, used by 90% of the people out there and therefore is a big target. I mean, and has some, frankly, problems, or has had in its security features. And I've talked before about alternate browsers. And as I said, I think since the last time I was here, the Mozilla Firefox browser mm-hmm. has come out as a 1.0 release. Prior to this, it's been what's called a beta release, and you know it's been there for people to use. And I think I've been using it for a long time. I think it's been relatively stable for a long time, but just recently it was released in the 1.0 version and has gotten a lot of attention and millions of downloads, because there are a lot of people out there who have collected problems from these things that are aimed at Internet Explorer. So that's something, if you want to slip over to www.mozilla.org, and that's M-O-Z-I-L-L-A, you can pick up Firefox there. Now, just I think this week, the same folks, the folks at Mozilla, and these are volunteer programmers. This is an open source effort. You know, these things don't cost any money, so it mm-hmm. doesn't cost anything to download and use them. They've released the 1.0 version of their email program that's called Thunderbird. And if you go to that Mozilla site, www.mozilla.org, you can download that as well. And it includes some things that, again, Outlook Explorer, which is the big target, or Outlook, depending on which you use, big target because of all the people who use Windows. This has some things that are closed off so that you don't have as many problems.
Okay, very good. Well, we've got a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us. So first we talk with a caller on line one. Good afternoon.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
I have an iMac, and I'm fairly literate on the computer. I can do email and simple internet stuff. And I got a gift with an iPod, and I haven't a clue what to do with it. And what I was wondering is it difficult to insert it? Or my daughter is coming in December, you know, in a couple of weeks, and she knows a lot more than I do. So I thought, well, I would just wait and see what she can do with it. But in general, is it hard to deal with it?
No, ma'am, it shouldn't be. Who gave you the iPod?
Well, my son and daughter-in-law.
Well, you should thank them.
And they should know.
You should thank them.
Well, but they should know that I don't, you know, I don't know how to.
Well, I think once you get used to it, you'll probably really like it. I don't have any experience either. I'd be in your shoes, but I think that's a really happening gift there, and I think that once you figure it out, you'll really enjoy it.
Yeah, and here's basically what needs to happen. Okay.
Okay.
Your iPod probably came with a cable, right, that plugs into it, and one end of that cable plugs into the iPod, and the other end of that cable plugs into the computer.
Uh-huh.
There's a port on there. It's called a FireWire port. That's what Apple calls it. There are other names for it, but Apple's name for it is FireWire. And you could tell by the end of the by the connector there where it should plug in. And there should be on your iMac, or you can download and install if not, software from Apple called iTunes. That's the software that stores your music, digital files of your music. And when you plug that iPod into your iMac, iTunes should start up, and it should move all the music that's in your library on your computer into your iPod.
Well, where does this music come from?
Okay, you can do a couple of things. Okay, I assume you probably have some CDs, right?
Actually, I I don't.
You don't? Okay.
I don't know why they gave it to me.
That makes it a little more difficult for you. But if you get CDs, you can put those CDs in the CD drive of your computer.
Uh-huh.
And again, you open up iTunes, and you tell iTunes to import the music from those CDs, and it'll put it into its library, right? So then when you plug in your iPod, iTunes will move that music you've put in your library into the iPod where you can use it on the run there. Another way to get music is to buy it from a digital music store. Apple has a music store. It's connected with its iTunes software called the iTunes Music Store. You know, they've got hundreds of thousands of songs up there that you can purchase for 99 cents each, and also, you know, albums that you can buy for $7, $8, $9, whatever. And you just download those directly into your computer, and they go directly into iTunes, the iTunes software library. And then when you plug in your iPod, they go into your iPod.
It also does digital photos.
Yeah. Oh, really? Boy. They gave you the top of the line.
I don't even have a digital camera.
Well, then in that case, it's probably not going to be great for you in that way. But again, if you have a digital camera, there's should be a piece of software, and if not, you can download it and install it from Apple called iPhoto.
Uh-huh.
You'll plug in your iPod, and iPhoto will put those photos, if you've got it set for that, into the device there. So really, there's a little bit more to it than that, but mostly it's a plug-and-play operation.
Uh-huh. So it's simple once,
Yeah, once everything's set up. With your family coming, you might have them help you do this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And once it's set up, it should – my experience has been that it works pretty much flawlessly.
I may even give it to my daughter.
Well, she'd probably appreciate it if you did, but you might find it's pretty useful.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right.
Okay, you're welcome. Thanks for the call this afternoon. Some of these little devices, they have FM radios in them.
Uh-huh,
and really nice. What a nice present. Okay, let's talk with another caller. Line 4, I think, is where we're going to go next. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question. You hit on it just a little bit there before your last caller about spyware.
Uh-huh.
What is the best way to clean up a computer as far as getting rid of spyware?
Well, what you want to do is you want to get a hold of one of several different pieces of software that are designed to remove this stuff.
Okay, I've read Adware.
Yes, Adware is one. And make sure that you get Ad-Aware and not Adware without the hyphen, because Adware without the hyphen is actually kind of a scam that passes on spyware.
Okay, this is Adware with the hyphen.
Right, and the other one is the other one I usually recommend is Spybot Search and Destroy.
Okay,
both of those are free.
Right,
you can download them for free and install them. Now, it's an interesting thing. We have a fellow in town here, Eric Howes, who does a lot of research, really, on spyware and how it works and how to work against it. And he's got an interesting analysis that you might want to take a look at. I'm going to give the web address for that here. It's Spyware Warrior. That's all one word, spywarewarrior.com, and then /ASW-test-guide.htm. And Eric looks at the job that a number of these do. I've just suggested Adware and Spybot Search and Destroy. His testing shows that alone they may not perform as well as you'd like them to. In fact, in the past when I've talked to him, he suggests that it's probably a good idea to use, you know, two or three of these.
Well, we've ran Adware and the Spybot Search and Destroy.
You run them both?
But we still can't get rid of what's there.
Do you know what it is?
Not exactly.
Well, there are some.
And it's the computer genius in the family.
Right.
Away to school. And I was just wondering if you'd give me an idea of something else that would work.
Well, take a look at Eric's. Take a look at that web address I gave you, and look at Eric's analysis. He's got a number of others there that you might take a look at. And then I'll also say this: some of these things are so insidious and tenacious that it's very difficult to get rid of them. And people have, in fact, developed specialized tools to do so. The tool CW Shredder, which if you Google that, you'd probably find a number of places where it's you could download it.
He tried that.
That didn't work either, huh?
It didn't get it all either.
Well, this may be something else entirely. So what you kind of need to do is determine what it is, and then see if there is some kind of specialized tool to get rid of it. Because some of these things really hang on. They do not want to be removed.
Well, that's what we're finding out.
Yeah. They regenerate themselves. Some are designed to regenerate themselves once you remove them.
Every time you do one thing, they try again and try again and try again.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I understand it anyway. Is that right? Is that correct?
Well, yeah, yes.
On some of them?
Yeah, on some of them. That's right.
Okay. Is there any way to keep from getting them?
Well, there are a couple ways, I think, to keep from getting them. I just mentioned a couple of them a little while ago, and let me say it again. Use a different browser and use a different email program. We're talking about a Windows computer, right?
Correct.
And do you guys use Internet Explorer and Outlook or Outlook Express?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, go to Mozilla, www.mozilla.org, get Firefox, get Thunderbird, and replace Internet Explorer and Outlook Express with those.
Okay, so that will
now,
help.
Now, if you don't do that, are you using Windows XP?
No. Windows 98.
Okay, I was going to suggest that you needed to download the XP Service Pack 2, which at least attempts to close some of these holes. But, so your good option would be to, I think, to switch browsers and switch
really
browser and email program.
Like an antivirus or something simple to keep from getting
well,
these.
If you have an updated antivirus program, some of these will now catch some of this spyware, adware type stuff.
Okay. And if I know last time we ran adware, there was like 5,000 and something on my computer.
Was that the first time you ran it?
No, it was like the third time I'd run it. It seems like every time we get on the internet, we get 1,000 of them.
Yeah, I would suggest for you changing browser and email program.
Would a different internet service provider be different?
That shouldn't really have much to do with it.
It does.
Although it helps if your internet service provider has its own spam filtering and that kind of thing.
Right, virus filtering
email
filtering and stuff such as that.
Well, I'd say your best bet is to change your browser and change your email program.
Okay.
And remember, that's not a panacea. Okay, if you practice unsafe computing, so to speak, if you get junk email and you open it up and you open programs that are in that junk email or attached to it or click on links that are in there, you're exposing yourself.
Our ISP does do a good job of blocking junk email. As far as that goes, it doesn't come in. It goes to a junk email box, and you go through and check it and see if there's anything that slipped through that you want to open, and you can delete it basically without opening anything.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why I was wondering if anybody, if that would make a difference. So what you're telling me, it's not.
Well, it sounds like
having a different internet service provider.
No, it sounds like your internet service provider is trying to do what they can.
Right.
But a certain amount is going to get through. And if you're not careful with it, if you activate the programs that are connected to it, little attachments or, you look
right.
at the, you can hurt yourself despite their best efforts and your best efforts.
Is this going to keep getting worse, or do you think the government's going
Probably.
To step in and get stopped?
Yeah, I think it's going to, at least for a while, keep getting worse. I think it's difficult for any one government to do anything about it because, what does the U.S. government do with a spyware purveyor that's, located halfway across the world on some island in the middle of the Pacific or something?
Right.
There's not much you can do.
Yeah. Okey-doke.
You need to protect yourself.
Right. So. Well, that's just like protecting yourself from a bank robber or from a robbery. You can only do so much, and then it's just dumb luck.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
So I might throw in a couple things here real quickly before we move on these lines. And this is, if you're going to continue to use, I'm going to use Outlook Express because that's, a lot of people use Outlook too, but that's more professional than the folks we're just talking to generally here now. You know, there are a couple things you can do there if you insist on continuing to use Outlook Express, although, you know, I would counsel you to find an alternative. In the Tools menu, Options, and the Read tab, if you call that up and you check Read All Messages in Plain Text, that can help you because you're not getting messages in HTML web page format that can do active things, right? If you go into the View menu, Layout, and you uncheck Show Preview Pane, that can help you because you're not automatically opening. If you have the Preview Pane open, you're automatically opening that email message, and whatever action that is intended to do can then happen. But if you know, if you shut off that Preview Pane, you make the decision as to whether to open that message or not. And generally, you know, it's not absolutely assured that you won't have a problem, but generally if you don't open the message, bad things can't happen to you. If you just delete it, you should be okay.
Okay. Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line two. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Greg. Is it true that the new computers do not have floppy disk capability?
More and more, yes.
So I've got a bunch of floppy disk with my computer. So what does the buyer of a new computer without floppy disk drive do with that information? How do they transfer it?
Do you have it on a hard drive? Or is it only on floppy drives?
Floppy disk.
Well, what you're going to want to do is move it to a hard drive and then move it over.
So how do you move it from a hard drive to move it to a new computer, though?
Well, you can. There are a variety of ways you can do that. One is, say, if as many people do now, you have a home network, you just network them together and move the stuff over that way.
Yeah, I don't have a home network.
You can make a direct cable connection. Depending on what kind of ports are on each computer, you know, you can get a USB cable or a serial cable and connect the two computers and set up a direct cable connection and drag them over that way. Do you have a CD burner in your old computer?
No.
Okay. So the other thing I would suggest, and this is a thing I've been suggesting to people for a while now since hard drive prices fell, is to get a hard drive, an external hard drive, that you can plug into the old computer, put your stuff on it, and then plug into the new computer and put your stuff on the new computer. Not only that, get a hard drive, an external hard drive. I generally suggest an external hard drive because of the ease of plugging it and unplugging it. Get one that's as big as the hard drive on your new computer. Okay. Now you got a backup device. Once you move the stuff from your old computer to your new computer, you can get rid of you can clear the hard drive, and now it's a backup device. And you know, you can back up your new computer into that hard drive, once a month or whatever.
So the step would be moving the information from the floppy disk onto the hard drive of the current PC.
Right.
Get an external hard drive and then transfer it from the hard drive on the PC into the external hard drive.
Right.
And then when you get the new computer,
plug it in and transfer it there.
Transfer it into the new one.
Right.
Okay, fine.
It is convoluted, and I hear the doubt in your voice there. But again, I'll say the advantage of it is of doing it that way. The easiest thing to do is, barring a new floppy drive in the new computer, the easiest thing to do is to establish that direct cable connection and just drag it over that way.
Yeah.
You know, the cable doesn't cost you more than a few bucks, and, all the software you need to do it is there.
Yeah.
So that's the easiest thing to do. I suggest the external hard drive option, again, because it gives you a backup device. You know, and external hard drives just aren't that expensive anymore.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, great. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Next, we talk with a listener waiting on line three. Hi.
Hi. Thinking about music, I have some LPs that have my kids' music on it from their childhoods. I'd like to make CD copies. It's no longer available. Mr. Rogers,
uh-huh.
I looked, couldn't find them anywhere. It was hard to find them in the first place. And my kids really enjoyed going to sleep to his gentle songs. So I'd like to make copies since I can't buy it, and I'm wondering if it's feasible to do that with my XP computer.
It depends on what you consider feasible. do you have a – well, the first question is, do you have a turntable and a stereo receiver?
Yes, I do.
So you've got a traditional stereo system there.
Well, it's sort of sitting on a side, but I can put it back together again. Yeah.
Yeah. So pretty much you get a two-headed cable, essentially, okay, that one end of it has the two RCA plugs that plug into your stereo, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the other end into your receiver, not into the turntable. You got the turntable plugged into the receiver too, right?
Well, I can.
Yeah. And the other end has a mini plug, you know, like a little headphone jack like you'd use for a portable CD player or something like that, that'll plug into the sound card on your computer. If you'll look back there, there are ports for that. There's a line in port.
Okay.
So now you put it in, you plug the RCA ends into the stereo receiver, you plug the mini plug end into your computer, you put the record on and you play it, and then in your computer you need to get a piece of software, and there, if you Google it, you can find several options that is a an audio capture title.
Okay. And, are there any that are affordable without being do a decent job without?
Yeah, yeah. There are a number that are either freeware or shareware, or you can spring for a commercial package that may have more bells and whistles, depending on how good a sound quality you want to get and all that.
So do you have any recommendations?
Not particularly one over another, no. Just run it through Google or go to the software download site, www.tucows.com.
TUCOWS.com. Okay.
And type in something like audio capture software or sound capture software, and you'll get a number of options you can look at. So then essentially what you're doing is you're running the record, your receiver is jacked into the audio input port on your computer, you fire up that sound capture software, and it makes a digital recording of the record you're playing, right?
Okay.
Now, you can do it all as one big file, the whole record is one big file, or you can do, tracks. You can play one song and then stop it and then play another song and stop it and make separate files for each track.
Mm, okay.
And then all you have to do is burn that to a CD as as an audio CD, which Windows will do itself, or again, you can get sound packages that have more bells and whistles than the inbuilt capability of Windows.
Okay, now here's a variation on the theme. What if I want to read a book to a distant grandchild and put my reading of the book onto a CD?
All right. Well, I think what you'd want to do is something similar, except now you're probably going to plug a microphone into your line-in jack, right?
Okay.
And there, you go to the store, there are lots of computer microphones. And again, you use that audio capture software to make a digital file of you reading. And then you just burn it to a CD in audio CD format.
Okay. Thinking about this business of leaving one's computer on all the time,
mm-hmm.
There was just an article in Consumer Reports about the adapters. I have a laptop, and it has one of these power adapters. And it's saying that there's going to be new regulations the government's putting out to increase their efficiency, that they use a lot of electricity stepping down the power.
Right.
And that lots and lots of things have them inside them. I don't know whether a desktop does, but I imagine that it does. And that when we leave our computers running all the time with the screens up and so forth, that we're using a lot of power collectively.
Right.
And so we should be thinking about upgrading our adapters, for one thing, if we can,
mm-hmm.
and two, not just leaving the daggone computer sitting there humming away while we're not using it.
Right. Well, I'll say two things here. One is I wouldn't suggest that you leave your laptop on all the time.
No, I don't.
Because of the confined space of the laptop and the heat that builds up that is not good for the components. You don't have the big case and all the fans that you have with a desktop machine.
Mm-hmm.
And now, the second thing I'll say is there's no way around the fact that, yes, you're using more power if you leave your computer on all the time. But the fact is the machine itself, when it's not working, is not using that much power. What's using a lot of power, as the guy who called about universal power supplies noted earlier, is your monitor, your big monitor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not hard to set your monitor to go off after a certain amount of time. In my case, I have it set to go off after an hour, you know. And so the computer's still there collecting whatever it's collecting for me, but the monitor's not burning all that power. It's in standby mode, low power mode.
Mm-hmm. I've walked past some people's computers. The person's not anywhere near around, and they have a slideshow set up.
Mm-hmm.
And the computer screen keeps changing the slideshow. Nobody's watching it.
Right, right.
And I'm thinking, we're not paying attention to
right.
these things. And even, I mean, at some point it doesn't make sense to pay attention to it, but when we add up all of this extra stuff that we're using power for, when we're not actually needing it, all those things contribute to our
right.
energy dependence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's something to keep
right.
in mind.
Your point is well taken.
Yeah.
And it also, it is some wear and tear on your computer to leave it running like that. So if you plan to keep it for a long, long time, that might not be the best strategy either.
Okay. Thanks for the call. And we've got a number of other folks waiting to talk with us. Let's go next to a listener on line one. Good afternoon.
Oh, hi. I think most of my questions actually were answered by your previous caller. But I have a small handheld Arcos. It's like a little hard drive, but it also has MP3 software in it.
Uh-huh.
And you can record onto it, but it records into MP3 format. And I have a son who likes to play the piano, and I like to record it when he plays. But I wanted it in CD format as opposed to MP3 format.
Yeah, and that's not any problem. If you have it in your computer, it's a digital file, an MP3 file, right?
Yeah.
When you burn the CD, whether you burn it in Windows or you burn it in something like Toast or Nero or one of the commercial programs for doing this kind of thing, you just tell it that you want to burn it. As it'll usually say, audio CD. You want to burn it as an audio CD. It may have another name, but usually it'll say audio CD for simplicity's sake. And then it takes those MP3 files and turns them in to the kind of file that plays in, you know, your garden variety CD player in your car or portable or with your stereo or whatever.
Okay, so I don't have to have any special software since the software is already in the Arcos.
Special software to...
I've got the software for recording it in
right.
the Arcos, right?
Right.
And, I mean, you just drag and drop it onto the computer. And so then the CD burner should be able to do that, huh? To convert it into a proper CD file.
Yes. I suspect that your jukebox there, it came with software for your computer, too, right?
Yeah.
Probably like Music Match or
yeah,
something
Music
like that.
Matches, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure, as I recall, that Music Match will burn, audio CDs for you. So
okay.
I believe all you'll need to do is plug in, plug your jukebox into your computer, get Music Match to, collect the files from it, and then turn those into CDs.
Okay, and then you can just play them on any old CD.
Yeah, if you burn it as an audio CD, it's made to be played in standard
CD. What's
the
suffix of that kind of a file?
Oh, boy. I wish you hadn't asked me that because I'm going to draw a blank and I should know it right off the top of my head. But let me look it up real quick here and I'll say it as soon as I find it. I just...
Yeah.
Yeah. If you want, you can get the information off the air and just stay tuned. And Greg is in front of the computer and... He's looking it up at the moment. So
it's a good thing I'm not playing against that guy on Jeopardy.
Is he still on?
No, I think he got beat finally.
Okay. All right. I should hum the music, huh? Greg Klein is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. This is a program, a topic we take up every month on the third Thursday of the month. We call it Computers and You. Greg Klein is science and technology reporter for the News Gazette. Any luck?
Yeah. It should be it should be CDA or CDAA, which means, as I recall, a compact disc audio.
Okay. Well,
that'd make sense, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Okay. So, the correct answer is CDA?
You'll get CDA or CDDA.
Okay, so. Very good. Let's talk with another listener. Let's go to a listener on line four. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I have a very short question. You were talking about the antivirus protection of, was it Firefox and Firebird, downloading them?
Yeah.
Does that, number one, does that cause you to lose all your previous emails in your memory? When you do that?
There are ways of, you mean the emails you saved previously, like an Outlook Express?
Yes.
They have ways built into them to export your email from Outlook Express and import it, say, into Thunderbird.
Uh-huh.
Or to export your bookmarks or favorites from Internet Explorer and export them into Firefox.
That doesn't happen on, this is a dumb question, but that doesn't happen automatically. You have to go through a process to get there, right?
As I recall, Firefox, when you first start it, asks you whether you want to do that.
I see. Okay.
I do not remember, because it's been a while since I installed Thunderbird,
okay,
whether it did or not, but it wouldn't surprise me if it did, because the people that are making these are good about stuff like that.
Okay, second quick question. Does it change anything in the emails that you get now? Do you have to resubscribe to whatever you're getting, or will you just keep on getting the same old emails?
No, it shouldn't make any, that shouldn't make any difference. Your address hasn't changed. You're going to the same server that you use. You know, you're putting in all your information,
uh-huh,
and it's just it's the same account.
Uh-huh.
You're just using different software to access it. Now, in the case of Firefox, you know, there may be some sites where you know, cookies store your sign on or something like that. Those cookies won't be present in that new version of Firefox that you got.
Okay.
So you may have to sign in again to create another cookie that's storing that information.
Uh-huh. Okay, one final question. You said you go to Mozilla.org, M-O-Z-I-L-L-A. Is that right, sir?
Right, www.mozilla, M-O-Z-I-L-L-A.org.
Thank you. You've been very helpful.
All right.
And let's see if we can get another call in now on listener on line two. Hi.
Yeah, so again, answered most of my questions, but if I have McAfee anti-spyware, and it tells me to clean out all that stuff. Now, when I clean out that, some of that stuff is looks like it's getting down into maybe root stuff that I don't want to do.
Well,
does it matter?
It's possible, okay, but okay. You're using McAfee, right?
Yeah, I'm using McAfee, and I'm using their anti-spyware, and it goes in and, you know,
right,
attacks everything, and then asks you, do you want to delete it? And, of course, I'm a little nervous about deleting some things, thinking I'll delete something that would cause me problems, you know, deeper in the computer.
That shouldn't happen.
Okay.
I will say two things, though. One is that, you know, some of the spyware gets itself locked into your registry, you know, which is the guts of Windows, the big database that Windows works off of. So as long as your anti-spyware software is being careful about what it's culling out of that registry, you should be okay. The other thing is that some anti-spyware programs look at some of the things that Windows does. You know, it's not necessarily spyware that's been installed on your computer. It's something that Windows has set up, and it's a setting, usually some kind of a setting, and it exposes you to spyware and adware. So essentially what it's doing is resetting that so you're no longer exposed. And again, it shouldn't cause you any problems.
Fox and Thunderbird both email sources, or are they just...
No, Firefox is a web browser.
It's a browser. That's what I thought you said. Okay.
And Thunderbird is its brother, the email program.
Gotcha. Okay, that's good. Hey, that's great. I tell you, I've had so much on material on Outlook, I couldn't bundle it. If I could, I'd make a lot of money. Thank you so much.
All right.
Okay, thanks for the call. And somebody like this listener, would he benefit by the Spy Warrior reviews and that kind of thing?
Yeah,
I think discussion.
It's a good discussion, and anybody would benefit from that. Let me give the address again. It's spywarewarrior.com. Spywarewarrior is all one word, .com. And then /ASW-test-guide.htm.
Okay, very good. And another useful site that I have found trying to explain something to other folks who've asked me a question is, I think, is it How Stuff Works?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, howstuffworks.com. Yeah. A lot of good yeah. information there.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, very good.
Not just about computers either.
That's right. I was like, all kinds of stuff.
Yes.
There.
Yeah.
Very good. Okay. Well, we're out of time. Went quickly. Thank you so much for joining us and helping out our listeners this afternoon. Greg Klein, science and technology reporter for the News Gazette, and I hope you'll be back in February.
I will be here.
Okay, very good.
Barring any unforeseen.
Yes. We'll keep our fingers crossed. Computers in You is a monthly feature of the Afternoon Magazine. We do this topic on the third Thursday of the month. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much. The last on the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, futures finished the day lower across that floor. In the wheat pit, they were down a nickel in the nearby March contract, a 297.5 settlement price today. The March wheat had a high of 304, a low at 297. And once again, the March soft red winter wheat settled at 297.5 today. It was down 5 cents. May contract, 310.5 high, low 304. Settlement price there, 304.5, 5 cents lower. And July, 318.5 the high, the low at 311. Settlement price at 311.5 off 5.25. Don't have this high and the low, but we do have the settlement price for the September contract. 318 settlement price down 5.5 cents. And next year's December, a 335 high, the low at 328. December wheat settled the day at the Board of Trade, 329 in Chicago, down 4.5 cents. From the corn pit, the nearby March contract, 205 high, low at 202.5. A settlement price at 203.5. They're off a penny and a half today. May futures, 212.5. The high, the low at 210.25. Settlement price at 211.25, down a penny and a quarter. July futures, 220.25 high, low at 218, settled 219, down 1.25. And the September corn for the day, 228.25 on the high side, the low at 226. Settlement price at 226.75. They were off a penny and a quarter for the day. December contract at 237.5 high, low at 235, settled at 236.5 off 3/4. And the March corn for next year, this is the 2006 contract, 244.25 high, low at 242.75. New March corn settled at 244, and they were off 3/4 for the day. March oats for the day, 159.5 high, low at 157. Settlement price up near the high at 159, down 0.25 cents for the day. And the May oats, $1.56.75, the high, the low at 155.25, settled at $1.56.25 a bushel. They were up 0.5 cent. From the soy complex now, nearby January beans, 551.5, the high, the low at 544. Settlement price, $5.44.5. They were off 1.5 cents today. The March contract, a 549.5 high, low at 541, settled $5.42, down 3.25. May soybeans, 553.5, the high, the low at 544.5, a settlement price at 545, down 4.25. And the July contract, a 559.5 high, low at 550, settlement price at 551.25. They were down 4 cents for the day. August contract now, 561.5, the high, the low at 554, settlement price down on that low at 554 for the August soybeans, down 4 cents. The September futures off 4 cents as well, 561, the high, the low at 553, settled on the low down 4 cents. And November contract for next year, the new crop beans, 569.5, the high, the low at 560.5, settled $5.60.75. They were off 5 cents for the day. January bean meal at 164 on the high, the low at $159 even, settled 160.30. They were off a dollar. And the March bean meal, 165.20, the high, the low at 159, settled 160.40. They were off 240 for the day. January bean oil now, $20.50, the high, the low at 20.21, settled 20.47 off, or rather up 21 for the day. And the March bean oil, 20.60, the high, the low at 20.29, settled at $20.57, and they were up 21 cents as well. We'll talk with Dan Zwicker at 6 after the next hour. That's after 2 o'clock Central Standard Time today, right here on the Closing Market Report. Up next, Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, Todd, it was a higher day today for lean hogs, while feeder cattle finished lower. January feeder cattle, 102.67.5 the high, 101.75 the low, 101.77.5 the settlement, that down 30. March, 98.60, the high, 97.40, the low, 97.52.5, the settlement, that down 57.5. April feeders, 97.10, the high, 96.40, the low, 96.50, the settlement, that down 30. December live cattle, 86.90, the high, 85.90, the low, 86.60, the settlement, that up 60. February live cattle, 88.47.5, the high, 87.80, the low, the settlement, 87.97.5, that finishing down a dime. February lean hog, 73.67.5, the high, 71.75, the low, 73.32.5, the settlement, that up 87.5. April, 72.37.5, the high, 70.25, the low, finishing at 72.15, up 125. May, 71.90, the high, 70.25, the low, 71.72.5, the settlement, that up 52.5. And June, 73.55, the high, 72.25, the low, the settlement, 73.52.5, that up 50. February pork bellies, 98.65, the high, 97.50, the low, 98.12.5, the settlement, that finishing down 45 cents. The Dow Jones Industrial Average down 14 points at 10,678. The NASDAQ off 21 at 2141. And the S&P 500 down 6 at 1200.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Sugen Shin from Ojai, California writes, Dear Dr. Science, would your car tires wear more if you were driving in the direction of the Earth's rotation or in the opposite direction?
None of the above. Tire wear is only evidenced by those who habitually travel north or south. Fortunately, they tend to follow a trip in one direction by another in the opposite direction, and that way the tires wear evenly on both sides of the vehicle. Travel from east to west actually tends to add rubber to the tires, picked up from microscopic bits of rubber worn off the tires of preceding vehicles. The process is technically quite complex. Suffice it to say, it involves electrostatic charges, free hydroxyl bonding, and crazy glue. Travel from west to east does wear down tires, but it wears down drivers even more. The thought of going to an overpopulated, expensive, polluted area causes erratic driving, full of sudden stops and much lurching.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's